Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Twitter says it will begin testing a new editing tool for tweets in the coming months. The tool would permit users to remove or add information to published tweets. Some well-known Twitter users, including Kim Kardashian, Ice-T, and Katy Perry, have urged the company to permit the editing of tweets. American businessman Elon Musk is another famous user who has publicly called on Twitter to add an editing tool. Musk is head of the American companies Tesla and SpaceX. Twitter's first message about the editing tool was published in a short tweet on April 1st, April Fool's Day. The tweet, from Twitter's official account, said simply, "We are working on an edit button." On April 5th, Twitter's Vice President of Consumer Products, Jay Sullivan, confirmed that the message was not an April Fool's joke. He wrote that Twitter had been exploring how to build an edit tool since last year. Twitter said the decision was not linked to the company's announcement that Musk had joined Twitter's board of directors. Musk's investments in the company currently total about 9.2%, making him Twitter's largest individual shareholder. His share is reportedly worth nearly $3 billion. In the past, Musk had been critical of some of Twitter's policies related to free speech issues. He recently created a poll on Twitter that asked users if they believed the service was committed to permitting free speech for all individuals. Musk also created a poll that asked users if they supported the idea of an editing tool for tweets. Twitter chief executive Parag Agrawal had urged users in a tweet to vote carefully in the poll, which drew about 4.4 million people. The poll showed that 74% of users want an edit button added to Twitter. About 26% opposed the idea. Some people who study Twitter say that adding an edit button would likely change the nature of the service. It would become less valuable as a historical record that stores official statements by politicians and other well-known people. Jennifer Greigel is a communications professor at Syracuse University in New York. She is an expert on social media who researches propaganda. Greigel told the Associated Press that Twitter, for better or worse, has become the de facto news wire. Greigel warned that with an editing tool, users could change important or controversial tweets without leaving evidence of the original statement. Greigel suggested giving Twitter users a period of time to edit their tweets before they are published. Twitter officials say they will test the feature in its paid service called Twitter Blue. Vice President Sullivan tweeted that the coming months of testing will be spent learning what works, what doesn't, and what's possible. I'm Brian Lynn.
Pakistan's parliament elected opposition lawmaker Shahbaz Sharif as prime minister Monday. He replaces Imran Khan, whom parliament had voted out of office early Sunday. Shahbaz Sharif was elected with 174 votes after more than 100 lawmakers from Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or Pakistan Justice Party, left the National Assembly in protest. Mohammad Shahbaz Sharif is declared to be the Prime Minister of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, announced the acting speaker, Asad Siddiq. Sharif is the younger brother of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. The older Sharif was forced to resign from office after a corruption investigation. Shahbaz Sharif will have just enough votes to pass laws in the 342-seat assembly. Imran Khan served as Pakistan's prime minister for 3 years and 8 months. On April 3rd, Khan tried to avoid a vote to withdraw support for his leadership. He dismissed parliament and called for early elections. The opposition appealed to the nation's Supreme Court, and it ruled to return the dismissed parliament to power 4 days later. On Sunday night, Khan urged hundreds of thousands of supporters to protest his ouster. Khan's supporters marched in cities across Pakistan. Khan has demanded that elections be held before August 2023, the date set. He also accuses the opposition of working with the United States to remove him from power. He said he was targeted because of his independent foreign policy favoring China and Russia. The U.S. State Department has denied any involvement in Pakistani politics. Khan was also criticized for a visit he made on February 24th to Moscow. He held talks there with Russian President Vladimir Putin as Russian tanks invaded Ukraine. I'm Katie Weaver.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Since the pandemic started, experts have warned of a mental health crisis facing American children. That is now happening in the form of increased depression, anxiety, eating disorders, fights, and thoughts of suicide. Last December, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy spoke about the urgent need to address the nation's youth mental health crisis. He said that in early 2021, emergency room visits in the U.S. for suspected suicide attempts were 51% higher for teenage girls and 4% higher for teenage boys, compared to the same period in 2019. Sharon Hoover, is a professor and co-director of the National Center for School Mental Health at the University of Maryland. She said child abuse and neglect increased during the pandemic. Students who lacked technology or good internet connections were isolated more than others. They fell behind in their studies and socially. And returning to school increased the anxiety of some children. We cannot assume that, okay, we're back in school. It's been a few months, and now everyone should be back to normal. That is not the case, said Hoover. The silver lining, which means a good thing to come from a bad situation, is special mental health training for teachers. This training helps teachers learn warning signs of mental health risks and substance abuse in children, and how to prevent a tragedy. The program is run by the National Council for Mental Well-Being and is available in every state in the U.S. One teacher taking the training is Benito Luna Herrera. He teaches 7th grade social studies in a high poverty area of the Mojave Desert, a 2-hour drive from Los Angeles, California. Just 2 weeks after the training, he saw a student arguing online with her then boyfriend. I asked her if she was okay, he said. Little by little, the girl told Luna Herrera about problems with friends, her boyfriend, and at home. She said she felt alone. The 12-year-old told Luna Herrera she had considered hurting herself. The training taught him how to handle such a crisis. Raise the alarm. Get expert help. Do not leave a person thinking about suicide alone. As Luna Herrera continued talking to the girl, he texted school officials. They called an emergency number, sending police to the girl's home. The police spoke with her mother, who was surprised about her daughter's suicidal thoughts. Catherine Aguirre, who leads the Mojave Unified School System, said he absolutely saved that child's life. The training helps teachers recognize the difference between normal ways of dealing with pressure and warning signs of serious mental suffering. Those warning signs can be clear or they can be hidden. For example, warning signs include talking about death or suicide. But saying, I can't do this anymore, or I'm tired of this, could be warnings too. Changes in behavior could be cause for concern. For example, a teacher might be concerned if a child stops an activity they loved without replacing it with another, is usually tidy but starts looking untidy, has falling grades or stops completing assignments, eats lunch alone every day, stops spending time with friends. After seeing that something might be wrong, the training teaches the next steps. Ask the student about their situation without pressure or judgment. Let them know you care. Let them know you want to help. The training tells adults to ask open-ended questions. These questions need more than simple yes or no answers. The goal is to keep the child talking. The adults are advised to see the importance of the problem and avoid saying, "You'll be fine," or "It's not that bad." They are also advised to not put themselves into a child's problems with comments such as, "I went through that too." And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the movement for civil rights for Black Americans. The day is August 28, 1963. More than 250,000 people are gathered in Washington. Black and white, young and old, they demand equal treatment for Black Americans. The nation's most famous civil rights leader, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., is speaking.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
Early in its history, Black Africans were brought to America as slaves. They were bought and sold like animals. By the time of America's Civil War in the 1860s, many had been freed by their owners. Many, however, still worked as slaves on the plantations or large farms of the South. By the end of the war, slavery had been declared unconstitutional. But that was only the first step in the struggle for equality. Most people of color could not get good jobs. They could not get good housing. They had far less chance of a good education than white Americans. For about 100 years, blacks made slow gains. Widespread activism for civil rights did not really begin until after World War II. During the war, Black Americans earned respect as members of the armed forces. When they came home, many demanded that their civil rights be respected too. An organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, led the way. In 1951, the organization sent its lawyers to help a man in the city of Topeka, Kansas. The man, Oliver Brown, and 12 others had brought legal action against the city. They wanted to end racial separation in their children's schools. That policy was known as segregation. At that time, 2 of every 5 public schools in America had all-white students or all-black students. The law said all public schools must be equal, but they were not. Schools for white children were almost always better than schools for black children. The situation was worst in southern states. The case against the city of Topeka, Brown versus the Board of Education, was finally settled by the nation's highest court. In 1954, the Supreme Court ruled that separate schools for black children were not equal to schools for white children. The next year, it said public schools must accept children of all races as quickly as possible. In September 1957, a black girl attempted to enter an all-white school in the city of Little Rock, Arkansas. An angry crowd shouted at her, State guards blocked her way. The guards had been sent by the state governor, Orville Faubus. After 3 weeks, a federal court ordered Governor Faubus to remove the guards. The girl, Elizabeth Eckford, and other black students were able to enter the school. After 1 day, however, riots forced the black students to leave. President Dwight Eisenhower ordered federal troops to Little Rock. They helped black students get into the white school safely. However, angry white citizens closed all the city's public schools. The schools stayed closed for 2 years. In 1962, a black student named James Meredith sought to attend the University of Mississippi. School officials refused. John F. Kennedy, the president at that time, sent federal law officers to help him. James Meredith became the first black person to graduate from the University of Mississippi. In addition to fighting for equal treatment in education, black Americans fought for equal treatment in housing and transportation. In many cities of the South, blacks were forced to sit in the back of buses. In 1955, a black woman named Rosa Parks got on a bus in the city of Montgomery, Alabama. She sat in the back. The bus became crowded. There were no more seats for white people. So the bus driver ordered Mrs. Parks to stand and give her seat to a white person. She refused. Her feet were tired after a long day at work. Rosa Parks was arrested.
For a number of years, the Negro passengers on the city bus lines of Montgomery have been humiliated, intimidated, and faced threats on this bus line.
The Reverend Martin Luther King organized the black citizens of Montgomery. They were the major users of the bus system. They decided to stop using the buses.
At present, we are in the midst of a protest, the Negro citizens of Montgomery, representing some 44% of the population. 90% at least of the regular Negro bus passengers are staying off the buses, and we plan to continue until something is done.
The boycott lasted a little more than a year. It seriously affected the earnings of the bus company. In the end, racial separation on the buses in Montgomery was declared illegal. Rosa Parks' tired feet had helped win black Americans another victory in their struggle for equal rights. And the victory had been won without violence. The Reverend King was following the teachings of former Indian leader Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi urged his followers to reach their political goals without violence. One of the major tools of nonviolence in the civil rights struggle in America was the sit-in. In a sit-in, protesters entered a store or public eating place. They quietly asked to be served. Sometimes they were arrested. Sometimes they remained until the business closed, but they were not served. Some went hours without food or water.
Buses are a-coming. Oh, yeah.
Another kind of protest was the Freedom Ride. This involved buses that traveled through states from the north to the south. On freedom rides, blacks and whites sat together to make it difficult for officials to enforce racial separation laws on the buses. Many freedom rides and much violence took place in the summer of 1964. Sometimes the Freedom Riders were arrested. Sometimes angry crowds of whites beat the Freedom Riders. Perhaps the most dangerous part of the civil rights movement was the campaign to win voting rights for black Americans. The 15th Amendment to the Constitution said a citizen could not be denied the right to vote because of race or color. Several southern states, however, passed laws to try to deny voting rights to blacks for other reasons. Martin Luther King and his supporters demanded new legislation to guarantee the right to vote. They held protests in the state of Alabama. In the city of Birmingham, the chief law officer ordered his men to fight the protesters with high-pressure water hoses and fierce dogs. People throughout the country watched the demonstration on television. The sight of people, including children, being beaten by policemen and bitten by dogs, awakened many citizens to the civil rights struggle. Federal negotiators reached a compromise. The compromise was, in fact, a victory for the protesters. They promised to stop their demonstrations. In exchange, they would be permitted to vote.
The freedom train.
President Lyndon Johnson signed a major civil rights bill in 1964. Yet, violence continued in some places. Three civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. One was murdered in Alabama. Martin Luther King kept working toward the goal of equal rights. On April 4, 1968, he died working toward that goal. King was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. He had gone there to support a strike by waste collection workers.
Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face.
CBS newsman Walter Cronkite.
Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck.
A white man, James Earl Ray, was tried and found guilty of the crime. A wave of unrest followed the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. Blacks in more than 100 cities in America rioted. In some cities, areas affected by the riots were not rebuilt for many years. The movement for civil rights for black Americans continued, but it became increasingly violent. The struggle produced angry, bitter memories. Yet it also produced some of the greatest words spoken in American history.
When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.